Let's go back a little bit to understand. I'm a historian by training, so I always use the historical approach to go somewhere. So too bad for all of you techies who don't know anything about history, but for once you'll have a little history course, which is good for your health. My MS stands for Meistersinger, and as for that, I forgot that I didn't know what Wagner had been in that for. Anyway. The story I'm going to tell is very quick, as I started saying yesterday, the whole modern scientific world really started in the 17th century when people started publishing in a somewhat organized way. The results of their research, and then go through the whole story again of how the philosophical transactions were published in 1665 in the Royal Society of London, but to make it very long story short, let's say that's where it starts. And at that point, you might say that through institutions that want to create value for their own scientists and yet accumulate the maximum amount of information about everything that goes on into Europe at the time, they start bartering their publications against the publications of other similar academies, societies, whatever you want to call them, and start building up libraries of scientific literature in a very cheap way. With one journal, 500 copies, you could get 500 journals, essentially, which is a nice way of doing it. It's still being done, by the way. It's still being done. I was in Belgium recently, and this is not a Belgian joke. And the Belgians in an agronomy school, and they published a small agronomy journal, and I was laughing because they were selling that to 70 people, and yet when they said, well, so why don't you give it away? You're subsidizing, you just sell it to 70 people and say, yeah, but if we give it away, we can't barter it anymore. And if we don't barter it, we don't get 370 other journals. Yeah, so they're doing this sort of thing still going on. The point is that for a very long time, in effect, the sort of semi or pseudo commercial dimension of journals, the pricing, if you want to put on the journals, was really a device to create a system of exchange, a way of organizing the general collections of science. Now, this whole thing developed and changed slightly in the 19th century. These learned societies multiplied the diversity of the publishers increased. Official publishers remain a very marginal and very, very secondary phenomenon in that they played, in fact, just in fact, or had a role in this function. I won't go into that, but they're always very secondary and marginal. When the Second World War came, the major phenomenon that took place after the Second World War was a phenomenal increase in the amount of publishing. Suddenly, science publishing really went haywire. And that created a first sort of, we go through crisis. We always go through crisis. In fact, the only thing continuous in life is crisis. And the first crisis that people talked about in the late 40s and early 50s was a bibliographic crisis. It could not, science was going to drown into its own information. People could not retrieve any more information. It took 3, 4, and then 5, and 10 years to create the bibliographies to retrieve the stuff you needed. So imagine if you can't find the stuff for 10 years because you don't have the right tools. So that stimulated, of course, a movement to improve the whole situation. In passing, it destroyed a collaborative system which was really lovely and which should be re-explored. The American Chemical Society used to develop its chemical abstracts on the basis of a Linux-like system of volunteers sending it bibliographic references and creating the whole thing in a very free way at a very cheap rate. It was just the cost of production, essentially. The whole thing at that point was destroyed by the pretext or reality of the fact that this was no longer efficient enough. I question that it was not efficient. I think that actually it could be revisited, but that's a different story. This whole thing therefore forced people to revisit the bibliographic issue. And this bibliographic issue was in fact the site of at least one major innovation, which I suspect it's the Science Citation Index, which started really being created in 63. This is the work of Eugene Garfield. Does anybody here know the Science Citation Index? No one knows that. Well, the Science Citation Index, the idea is brilliant. It is, and the idea in fact is quite grandiose when you think about it. It's indeed to think, imagine all the scientific journals of the world, and imagine you could specific reasons, the field of genetics was really exploding at the time, and with the help of Lederberg, who was a recent Nobel Prize, sort of rather unusual Nobel Prize. He got his Nobel Prize with his PhD thesis, which isn't bad. But I guess his... Did it too, but that was a bit earlier. Yeah, I don't know what his thesis director said about that, but that's a different issue again. Lederberg was complaining about the fact that in the field of trust just emerging and by necessity was very transdisciplinary. You needed information from many, many fields. All the tools there were not terribly interesting to find the information, but a citation system would be very interesting to find that information. So he was pushing Garfield to develop his science citation index. Long story short, again, Garfield started in 63. He did it in a way which at the time looked perfectly reasonable, certainly not in a malevolent fashion. It was pragmatic. It was a way to try to solve a very difficult problem in operational terms. What was the problem? It was very simply that you just could not build a home with a web of science much too big. So you had to find some manner justifying doing only a part of it, and yet showing that part was significant, in fact essential, so that in effect by looking just at that part, you were not losing all that much information. Now to do that, Garfield went through a kind of analysis which stemmed from the librarians. In the 30s, the librarians came to the, under very deep, of course, financial pressures, and they started trying to calculate how to decrease, you might call, the cost per use of their documentation. Ideally, if you could have exactly the kind of documentation all the people of your constituency need when they need it, and just that, your cost per use would be minimal. And that would be the ideal situation. So, not being able to do that, they tried to develop statistical approaches to try and approximate this kind of idea. And the thing that came out of that was the work of an Englishman called Bradford, who developed the so-called Bradford Law, which roughly says, you know, if you need so many articles that are relevant to you in order to increase arithmetically those numbers of journals, of articles, you'll have to increase geometrically the number of journals. So, you know, well, if you want to triple, quadruple, and so on, it becomes quickly a thing that becomes exponential. So, what most people are doing, we all know that. We never do an exhaustive bibliography of anything because, of course, it becomes infinite. We know that at some reasonable point we've covered the essential part. We haven't missed anything really important. And we stop there, and we know we've got the core information of our field. Now, the librarians developed that and discovered that they could sort of play that to under inside the institution to do a more rationalized approach to buying documentation. Keep that in mind because it's going to be a side but important element for the continuation of my little story. Garfield took that in reverse, and that's when he made this kind of shortcut, which again was pragmatic and led to really perverse effects. He said, well, in effect, you know, if each individual has a kind of core literature that he can read or she can read to, that's perfectly understandable. I never really naturally does that. We subscribe to 6, 7 journals, or 3 or 5, depending. We know that already. We get some of the essential stuff. Then we go to the library for the next 10 or something like that. If we did that for each person, what I can do, he claimed, was to really conflate all of that into one simple collection of journals, which he called the Garfield Law of Concentration, which reverses the law of Bradford. And he said, in effect, if I just look at that, I'm going to have what I need to do my science citation index. And the important thing is that he claimed and did some calculations that he could actually hit the center of science. And that's where the myth comes in. Science is not a unified thing. But if I can define a mythical center of science, and I can define it quantitatively, and if I hit that, I'm going to have a way to do my science citation index in a way which becomes operational. And that's what he did. He decided that 1,600 journals at first, now it's about 6,000, were the so-called core journals. And that's how the notion of core journal appeared. writes you so what? It's not so important to have cordialism. It's nice. We have no. In fact, it may be helpful. We can perhaps now look more effectively at the journals because we can push aside those that are not the core journals. Keep on with the core journals and go to the others only in case of dire need. Most of the time we can limit ourselves to that. And that's exactly what the librarians tended to do, because they found that this was probably the best way to build a reasonable collection for their institutions, which first bad effect meant that all the libraries are buying roughly the same stuff, which is not very intelligent. I mean, on the basis of human diversity or cultural diversity, it's not very intelligent. That's again another issue on the other side. And the second thing, which was more less visible, more insidious, was the fact that science has never been an egalitarian system. We all know that. It's a highly competitive bunch of egotistical guys and women who just want to say they're better than each other. But they want to do it to the level playing field. You know, at least they accept to have, you know, a flat ground in the same size goals and something like that. So something at the base should be relatively equal. Now, when you say that you have suddenly identified in this sort of continuous hierarchy of going from mediocrity to excellence, when you start selecting the top part of that hierarchy and cutting it off from the other part of science, and by the very motion of doing that, you give a kind of surplus value to this amount, and then the rest sort of drops down a bit. It's a bit like being able to put your stock into a stock exchange or not. You know that as soon as your stock goes into a stock exchange, its value increases by 20% roughly. That's about the same sort of phenomenon that took place with these journals. And these journals, therefore, were immediately promoted to a state which, because they were cut off from the others, started to be a bit different from this quest of excellence on a continuous scale that used to be roughly the case of science. I'm not saying science is not an elitist, because I'm not throwing out the crucial word. I'm not saying science is not an elitist practice. It is. There are all sorts of barriers to get into science, but once you are inside that is that things were roughly even for the players inside, and you could count on an excellent seeking mechanism within an elitist system. To be sure, but still an excellent seeking system at work. Suddenly that began to derail. The situation is not too grave yet. We're in the 60s. The journals at that time are being sold and bought at prices which correspond roughly to their production costs, with perhaps a bit of benefit sometimes, because some granite societies like to subsidize some of their activities through their journals, but more or less, you know, the journals are in a relatively decent economic position, except that the few commercial publishers that had been marginal, secondary, and all that in this whole activity, suddenly realized that collection of journals, the core journals, they were wonderful, because these were journals that every library had to buy, because of that famous Bradford law and that kind of habit, cultural institutional habit. And you know what it becomes? A series of objects, when you can start dreaming about the fact that however much you increase the prices, people will still have to buy it. It's called in economic terms an inelastic market. The elasticity of the market is completely gone. So, some of the more clever people, and Robert Maxwell was one of the very first ones to see that, began to think that there was really some money to be made in scholarly and scientific publishing. Now let me make a small digression at this point, because I think we've got to put now this whole thing into context. Most of the fundamental scientific research in the world, including the United States, is financed by public money. NSF, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, to speak of the states. But it's even more so in most other countries. probably all know that. I mean, you probably have been told you that. When you review articles for journals, because these journals are so-called peer-reviewed journals, you end up paid again. Now, these journals, at first, are being bought by a medley of people, institutions, and all that, but as prices started to increase, of course, individuals dropped out. So that very quickly, the only entities buying these journals became institutions, namely libraries. Who subsidizes these libraries? Are they, again, public money? So you had public money producing research, research being evaluated but through public money supported people, and then the thing bought back by public money institutions. Now, so far so good, as long as the prices are, you know, in line with production costs. You might say people are just then using that commercial model to simply oil the wheels of this exchange of information to make it printed and disseminated. So far so good. But when the commercial publishers come along, then the prices start moving up, and the connection between production costs and actual costs of journals started to be completely, you know, two different worlds. Now, just as a test, do you know what the average price of a physics journal nowadays is per year? And you have any idea of the order of magnitude? That's about $2,000 to $3,000. It's in that area. Biology is about the same. Do you know, so $2,000 to $3,000 euros for one journal. And these journals are not that big, you know. This is the, then you get into that thing which the publishers are using. You see our prices have to go up because people don't have the real needed budgets to buy our journals, so they unsubscribe, so the market is, you know, shrinking, so the cost per unit, particularly the cost per fixed cost, the average fixed cost is higher, and that's what you're paying for. I mean, I mean, to have a journal, to sell it, one copy, to anybody who is willing to pay $1 million for that copy, and then say to that person, I'll distribute it any way you want. I've got my $1 million, and I'll go. So, I mean, no, they're not sawing off the branch on which they're sitting. Actually, the fewer customers the fewer costs they have managing subscriptions, sending stuff around. Okay? So, no, I mean, they're very happy with this thing. But they put the argument backwards, saying, well, you know, since you're fewer and fewer buying my stuff, I've got to increase the price. What they don't say is the rate of profit they make on this sort of thing. And again, do you have any idea of what the rate of profit is in a firm like Elsevier? Well, it's a bit higher. It's between 35 and 40 years old. We're talking again about research published with the help of public money, bought by public money. In the middle, you have this vampire standing, you know, sucking the blood of scientific communication and putting 40% of it in its own stomach. Not bad. And limiting its intuition, you're getting ahead of me, but you're perfectly right. You're exactly where I was going to go. It is the whole issue, because I was indeed going to say, what is the interest of the scientist when he or she publishes? Obviously not to lock up the results behind some financial wall. Ideally, a scientist would love to see his or her article sent to every human on the planet. I mean, that would be the ideal thing. And maybe many humans can read those articles, but it doesn't matter. At least, you know, you never know. At least you have a better chance of being submerged. It would be an interesting form of spying. Maybe we should think about that spamming science. Let's think in those terms. So, and it does. plutocracy. We are now in the plutocratic system of science, where a few rich institutions with vast resources can have full access to the scientific information and are in effect cutting off the rest of the world. Let's not even talk about the third world, because there the situation is completely dire until very recently. And I'll talk about that at the end of my presentation. The 60 poorest countries, which have nonetheless some of them, in fact most of them, have at least one medical school. These medical schools' libraries had not seen a new issue of a journal for the last 10 years. Not one. Now let's talk about the human consequences of that. Also, I mean, even people have limited resources in teaching new doctors if they can't even have some decent, recent information. Obviously, there is there something which becomes very close to my mind to being criminal. Don't have malaria, because that means you live in a country which probably cannot buy the journals that deal with malaria. For example, okay? So malaria, the biggest journal by malaria, by the way, is published by Elsevier. Again, the Microsoft publishing world. Now, all this was fine and dandy in the print world, then came digitization. Hey, have we been talking about that all day, haven't we? Digitization, networks, bits, oh, wonderful. So people started playing with all these things. The first ones to really get into the fray were the scientists themselves and the scholars themselves. Things really started moving around 89, 90, with the first journal starting appearing on a very, very, kind of bricolage, or it's in French, in 1990. is really a crazy funny idea of course it didn't fly was to really rely on the fact that bandwidth was very poor everywhere except on campus, so that you made the files as big as you could, and you put them on campus, and then with the biggest internet connection, you could look one page at a time. It took longer to print than if you printed if you Xeroxed an article from the printed version. And you certainly, I mean, you really had to read it one page at a time. And it was very cumbersome and everything, but everything was obviously organized on how can I control the damn thing? How can I control the damn thing? The lesson was not terribly, satisfactory. In fact, Princeton even pulled out. Michigan got all excited about it, but you know, when you're in Michigan, sometimes you don't know what to do. The others were cool, but everybody was sort of interested, but no, it was not really the way to do yet. And of course, Sasha said, well, no, there is only one way to create a good control of our thing. We've got to find a nice kind of format that can go through limited bandwidth, but we've got to find a nice control for it. And the control is so easy. Well, we know it. Well, we're stupid. We had it in TuneDL licensing, and we've got the right people to enforce the licensing system, the librarians. And the librarians went along. They went along. And you're going to say, why not? Well, I say, why should they? The point is that if you know anything about the North American tradition of librarians in particular, it's not so strong in continental Europe. In Britain, I don't know, but in continental Europe, except perhaps in the Scandinavian countries, librarians have not had that ethos as strong as in North America, perhaps Britain. But in North America, librarians have been staunch defenders of what might call the public space of reading. I mean, in fact, they are the countervailing institution allowing to compensate for the proprietary nature of printed books. And the first use provision of the American copyright law, which allows people to do with their book what they want, lend it and all that, is the basis of librarianship. Now, suddenly what Elsevier and the others are saying to the librarians is, okay, what you're going to do from now on is no longer buy journals from us, you're going to buy a temporary you're going to do the cops for us. And the most amazing thing about this story is that it took about 5 or 6 years for the librarian to suddenly realize that we're not cops. And we're doing what's this uniform on my back suddenly. Never worn that stuff before. I only need a gun. So the librarians found themselves in a real quandary, and that's how they started fighting back. I mean, first of all, their role was being undermined. The function of a public space of reading was being undermined. They found that they could not even develop collections anymore because what they were given were access to essentially, you know, collections. Most of the time things were bundled in such a way that in effect if you didn't take the horse and shebang, you were shooting yourself in the foot, at least for the first 3 years. Then of course you discovered that you should have shot yourself in the foot in the first 3 years to avoid being shooting yourself in the head in the next 6. But, this is the reasoning that goes on. You are a librarian, a director of libraries in a university. You're competing for funds within your university. I'm talking about the North American system, I think it's the same in Britain. You're competing for funds in your university against all the services inside the university. And one company says to you, look, we're going to offer you the following deal. You're buying up to now about 700 journals from us. I'm talking about our CBM again. And we have 1,700 titles to offer you, okay? You pay $1 million a year for the 700 titles right now. How about getting the whole thing for the next 3 years for $1.2 million? And look, we're going to go and see your boss, you know, the vice president or the vice rector. And you say, look, for $200,000 more, I've more than doubled the number of titles I'm subscribed to. Wonderful. So, except that when you come up for renewal, your bargaining chip against the publisher is pretty bad, because if you don't accept his terms, then he's going to say, well, let's go back to 700 titles, and it's been 20% or 30% more anyway. So, you know, that's what I mean, you shoot yourself in the head the second time. Second effect it does, which people don't think about, societies, what happens is that the market for these, the journals of the small societies is decreasing, and as they are very fragile, most of them, then they become extraordinarily, you know, what do we do? And then suddenly one day they get a phone call. Hello, here is Elsevier. Are you in trouble by any chance with your journal? We like your journal. We could give you a hand. We could even pay a secretary to help you. You as an editor, you're not paid right now, are you? No. Well, we could pay you a bit, you know, and we do have some meetings of editors you might like in Bermuda, in Hawaii, in Shanghai, don't worry about it, we're just going to raise the prices a little bit. So you have the, you know, the scientists on one hand being editors of these journals, being in fact kept in their roles, being promoted to this role of gatekeeper, because that's what they are, gaining more services this way in libraries on the other side, paid by this institution, by the way, of course, have to pay 3, 4, 5 times. In France, Center at one point put its journals under the cover of Elsevier, and they took them out later on in 2 years. The cost per page of the inner journals was multiplied by 4. And then could get better services for that. And so you had this series of transformations that were going on and on and deploying themselves from 95, 96 on to the present, in fact, it's still continuing. That's when a number of reactions set in. 2 major ones, and I'll conclude essentially with that thought. The first reaction has been that libraries themselves had to organize themselves to try and react against that, and they created consortiums of libraries to try and negotiate together to try and get better prices from these publishers. I'm a member of the Canadian Consortium. My complete evaluation of the situation after 3 years discover that when you produce such journals, it didn't cost all that much money. It was costly, but not that much. Not that costly. And at one point, people say, so why don't we do the publishing ourselves? Why don't we take back the control over this kind of thing? And in there, to go very quickly, a series of moves have started to develop. On the one hand, libraries have started developing a system that is called institutional repositories, where people can already put a lot of their publications to come or backwards in open access in their institutions. We can, if you're interested about the details, lots of, you know, details to be taken care of. Some publishers accept it, some don't, some sort of support it. It depends. And there are ways to circumvent that to some extent. But more interestingly, even, is the fact that all these institutional repositories have now coordinated to create a system of what technically libraries call metadata, that is essentially a thing of kind of library card system, so that people can harvest that information through one-stop business across hundreds of sites. If you want to just check how it looks, just look in Google and just spell OAISTER. OAI means Open Archive Initiative. It's a misnomer. It's not really about open archives, it's about interoperable archives. I mean, it can apply to closed archives, but it is interoperability you're talking about. And if you look at OAISTER, you'll find the OAISTER site, which will get you a taste of what one-stop harvesting can look like. The next stage, which is even more interesting, is that a number of institutions and companies, and this is hard because we're here using an interesting, are now trying to evaluate the possibility of creating journals where the cost should be shifted completely from back down at the subscription level to the upfront when people are getting published. Essentially, the scheme is the following. It takes so much to review and to publish a paper going to have it peer evaluated, and if it is accepted and you want it to be published, you'll have so much to pay. Now, the price per article, if you followed the Elsevier present rule, would be of the order of $6,000 or $7,000. The prices that have been presented by two entities right now is in one case a commercial entity, which I think right now is burning cash. I think they're not realistic, but they're doing it for $500. And a non-profit system, which is going to start in the fall, the Public Library of Science, in this case, which is largely out of Berkeley, by the way, and some people from Stanford, Michael Eisen out of Berkeley. These people are creating a public library of science with a unit price of articles at $1,500 for the articles. We're going to say that no scientist is going to pay $1,500, and you're right. But then now the mechanism is starting to roll. And that gives you ideas of how counter strategies can evolve. The granting agencies in the area of biomed research had a meeting at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in Chevy Chase outside Washington. This was an interesting meeting I went to. There were about 30 people, 3 Nobel Prizes around the table. I was impressed. We had the head of the Wellcome Trust elect of the Wellcome Trust. We had the head of NIH. We had a very high-ranking official from the Max Planck Institute. No one from France, obviously. I have dual nationality, French and Canadian, so that allows me to joke about the French. And so, what? Especially in Canada, I have two options, Quebecois or Canadian, so it makes life really interesting. These people were discussing essentially this following question. We're talking about granting agencies. They were not discussing whether publishing in open access journals was to be valued or supported on that. They were discussing, given that it is the right thing to do, should we force our beneficiaries publish in open access things? And the answer in April was, public Chamber of Science is starting with a grant from the foundation. And that foundation is the Moore Foundation. Moore is the guy from Intel. They gave $9 million to create an open access journal. Now there is a very interesting phenomenon happening in the American foundations right now. Rockefeller, MacArthur, Moore, OSI, and a number of others that I don't remember the others. They have had meetings, they are having meetings about how to protect the commons, the public domain, and some things like that. The foundations are suddenly understanding that all this is being encroached to an unacceptable, unhealthy level by the extensions of the copyright, the DMCA, and all these things that we've been talking in this meeting. And they're putting in millions of dollars right now to support efforts to create countervailing sort of things. It's an amusing thing that this spin-off from the worst capitalists of the world is doing better against present-day capitalism than our governments. It's really quite an interesting statement on our world. I think Hegel would be absolutely delighted. Hey, dialectics works. Maybe even Marx might be happy about it. Sorry for the 19th century references, I told you I was a historian, and I have to sometimes lapse, into these things. But the point of all this is that, it's not so hopeless. No, it's not difficult, but you're writing warning us and saying be careful, because it is a battle, it is a war, it's not going to stop. It's going to go, it's going on for centuries. We're just fighting our phase of that battle between, the private, the collective, and the public. And we're doing our bit to try and maintain an equilibrium. So let's do it, and let's do it well. So I would say this is the message I wanted to say through these journals and through these essence is essentially that the author is the owner of the text. The text can be reused, recirculated in any manner by any person that is doing research. As, oh yeah, you can use the text anywhere you want. Anywhere you want. Quote it, cite it, use its information, everything, circulate it, copy it, everything. For non-commercial, the author must be kept with the text. I mean, what we would call in author's rights, balance. Moral rights are essentially that's a UK man. Moral rights have their interest. I'm sorry about that. We can have a discussion about that if you want. I think moral rights are not so bad. They're being badly used in many cases. But if they're taken from the point of view of really the author and not the publisher, the problem is that moral rights are being abused by publishers, not by authors. From sell it, come give it away. It's yours. the good article has been peer-reviewed by the journal, and when it comes to discussing the thing that you want to reconsiderize, they don't want to give you the rights when you do. And you're not promoted yet, and you're afraid about your career. Okay? That's what you're saying, essentially, right?
Yes.
Because the question becomes very different if you are promoted and you have tenure, the permanence in your position, because then you say, you know, and you publish it in some other place. Let's change the terms slightly. I think the point is that being famous depends to have tenure. Okay, to be if you are independent in effect, yeah. If you're an old fart like me, okay? It's you can just go straight ahead, thumb your nose at the publisher and say, you don't want to give me my rights, give me back my article, go screw yourself, okay? And then you go someplace else, and what's going to happen in the coming years is that more and more access to more and more open access journals, and which create high value, are going to emerge. The real battle, and I forgot to say that, and it's important, the real battle that's going to emerge in the next 10 years is who's going to monopolize the right to create symbolic value for the authors. Right now, the big publishers are sitting on big logos. Nature, Cell, you know, that sort of thing. Science, these kinds of big logos. We're going to have to create alternative logos, just as good as in open access. That's what Public Library of Science is aiming at doing. That's what Biomed Central, with its 80s or some journals, is aiming at doing. And that's what every other similar sort of endeavor is going to aim at doing. With the Open Society Institute, we had a meeting in January in Budapest with a number, 22 actually, academies of the former Soviet zone. These are institutions which are really in bad shape, many of them right now. We're trying to help them sort of revitalize, revive, and improve the value, the granting capacity of their journals so that they can go into open access and at the same time really create some very interesting outlets for science in general. And what we must do, and that's such a Linux-like project, is to create a distributed science citation index and thumb our nose at I special because you won gloves. So we've got to do in well working on granting agencies and working on you should look at the Bethesda statement, which has been coming out recently, which will be in the Bethesda's BETHESDA statement. So I think if you already do that, you'll find that. If you just add a pseudonym like Vamos, the Nobel Prize VARMUS, on Google, you'll find it right away. If not, write to me. Okay, Nelson. No, they don't use impact factors, but on the contrary, they say the statement's interesting because it is divided by categories of stakeholders. And when they speak to administrators, they say, we agree to evaluate our research personnel according to the real quality of their papers and not where they publish. It's a mathematical procedure which has been designed, which incidentally is stupid for two reasons. One, it varies widely from one discipline to the next. Mathematicians, for example, cite relatively little compared to biomed scientists. That's the first point. The second point is that within a single journal, the order of magnitude, the difference between the most cited papers and the least cited papers is two orders of magnitude. So if you're going to something like a Nature of Science, which has impact factors over 30, which is very high, that means you have papers that range somewhere between 300 and 300. There are very few 300 papers. Most of the people are hanging on the cocktails of those few 300 papers. And some of these 300 papers, by the way, are highly cited because they are erroneous. On top of that, some of the most highly cited papers are erroneous. And that's why they're cited. And the point is that you're making measurements of the quality of people on the basis of an index, which really has no meaning for individuals, unless you create the index for individuals. It has never been done. So again, there is work that is being done. sites is there a software to do it? You know about that Parasite? CIT? Yeah. Parasite. Yeah. And, you look into the site of the University of Southampton, or you look into Google the name of my friend Stefan Hamad, H-A-R-M-E-D. It's the one that on the leash recognition device in my life. Thank you. century that physics and related fields around physics, mathematics, cosmogony, astronomy, those kind of things. The other one is biomed. The other thing is even more important. It's a Ginzburg's thing is extraordinarily important now for physicists. It is made of papers which are submitted as soon as they are essentially accepted within the local labs on peer review, non-peer review, and used them. And yet they are used extremely widely by the community. And in fact, the peer review is already done by the very usage that these papers receive. Some papers, of course, are being used and quoted widely in a very positive sense this time, and others, of course, are neglected or forgotten. Most of these papers are then submitted to papers. Turns out that in the physics community, most journals have now understood that they didn't have the way to stop maintaining that open archive despite the publication. So what they do, these journals nowadays, which points also to the future, is that they really act as the peer review, official peer review, baptism kind of thing, you know, the ritual. And that's why I think the future of scientific publishing in a monopoly is going to concentrate on the who monopolizes the sacrament granting agency, you know. I think the big publishers are going to become like the Catholic Church, you see, and they're going to monopolize baptism, marriage, you know, burials, things. And then you have competing publishers, called Anglicans, Baptists, and they provide the same services at a different price. Well, they all claim that if you don't go to theirs, it's the same there. If you don't go to the right publisher, your impact factor is going to drop. So your soul will be loaded down. And they're stealing people.